Hi, you're listening to Scream the Crime, a podcast where we talk about true crime, what would happen if your favorite TV or movie characters committed those crimes. I'm Maggie, and today my guest is...
Hi, I'm Dante. I met Maggie in high school, and now we're here to talk about a podcast, which I've never done before.
Yes, very fun, super fun. Dante lives in Tennessee, isn't that right?
I do live in Tennessee, it's true.
I was telling my friends at work about, I was like, Dante couldn't record last night because he had to go to Nashville. And they're like, why is he going to Nashville? And I was like, because he lives in Tennessee. And they're like, oh, I thought he was driving there from Rochester. I was like, no.
A crazy spur of the moment thing, but I've done crazier. I did drive to Chicago overnight one time.
That's far away from Tennessee, right?
It was like, I feel like it's like 10 hours. I don't really remember off the top of my head.
And you just drove there for fun?
Yeah. I mean, there was three of us and we decided, hey, would it be cool to go to Chicago and do some Chicago things for this weekend and then also be back in class on Monday morning? And we decided that, yes, that was a good idea. And then we did it and then we definitely were not back in class on Monday morning. But hey, we got to go to Chicago. I touched the bean.
Nice.
Saw pride flags because it was like Pride Week. It was cool.
Nice. I want to go to Chicago. I want to go to the Bean. I don't care about the rest of Chicago. I care about the Bean.
I think the Bean is the only thing really worth doing in Chicago. Maybe.
You know, I think some people might disagree.
Some people might disagree, but I'm here to say, as someone who went to Chicago for two whole days, the Bean is the only thing worth doing in Chicago.
Noted. I will plan my trip accordingly.
The second time I went, they also kicked me out. So my track record with Chicago might be a little bit biased.
They kicked you out of Chicago?
Well, it was the COVID thing. Oh. And we got off our airplane and got to the hotel. And they said, hey, actually, nobody can stay in this hotel. So bye. And we had to get back on an airplane and fly back to Tennessee.
That's awful.
That's what happens when you do things like travel with concerts in the middle of a global pandemic. Probably not advisable, dear listeners.
Thank you for those words of advice. I'm sure all my listeners that travel with concerts during a pandemic will note that.
Hey, I just try to reach all the demographics.
Of course. I mean, way more than I do. All I have is college students, 20 and under.
That's a good demographic to have, though. That's the cool people.
Gen Zs unite. Zillennials.
I don't know if I'm even a Gen Z or a millennial. I never actually learned the distinction.
Well, I did as a marketing student. You're in fact a Gen Zer.
Oh, wow.
We both are. But
so now whenever people call me a millennial, I can say, ha, no.
Yeah.
I'm Gen Z. Even cooler.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think Gen Zs are cooler than millennials. I mean, as much as I love to live, laugh, and love, Gen Zers are just a lot more funnier.
And I do like to drink craft beer and eat smoked meats, but I gotta say, Fortnite is up there on the list of things too, you know? where do we draw the line? Why can't we all be friends?
I mean, according to my TikTok For You page, we're actually Zillennials, which don't exist, but it's like a...
Zoomers.
Zoomers?
Yeah, I thought that was the Gen Z slang, was Zoomers.
Zoomers are Gen Zers, but Zillennials are the mix between Gen Z and Millennials, such as ourselves, because we weren't born with technology really, like, avid in our lives. Like, I didn't get a cell phone until sixth grade, but, like, we're also not Millennials, because Millennials, like, were, like, teens when that happened and stuff like that.
I work with an 18-year-old, and he said his first phone was an iPhone 2, and that blew my mind.
Yeah, that's crazy.
He's only 4 years younger than me.
Yeah.
Anyway, Maggie and Dante are
technology.
Old,
are. Yeah. No, I mean, I work with freshmen in college, and it's just such a big divide between me and them, and I'm only like 3 years older than them, which is crazy, you know?
Yeah, they're, but like, you're not a cool fresh out of high school teen like they are.
No, you're right.
They know all the trends.
I mean, I have a TikTok, but like, am I even like up to date? No, my whole TikTok's fucking children's shows.
I thought it was banned. I thought TikTok was banned. I thought that was happening.
I think it was.
That's how out of the loop I am.
It was supposed to be removed from the App Store or something like that.
Well, that never happened.
Anyway, I'm drinking beer tonight because it's Tuesday, and Tuesdays are my really busy days. And it's called Pucker Powder.
Is it a sour?
It is a sour. You are so great. You are so millennial for knowing that. It's a dry hopped sour ale, and it's by Buried Acorn. And my roommate got it for me when she went home. I think it's from someplace in upstate New York.
I love local stuff. I try to get it as much as possible. It's like in beer and in everything. I feel like it's almost always better. I'm not an IPA person though. And a lot of the local breweries around here just do IPAs all the time. I don't have any beer in my house, not one can right now. So I'm drinking, I'm holding in my hand a bottle of Jack Daniels, which is very appropriate to Tennessee, but also a bottle of Sailor Jerry, which is a spiced rum. And I'm not sure which one I'm going to
double fisting hard liquor right now.
I haven't opened either of them yet. So I could be double fisting. The potential is there. Right now, I'm just kind of double examining. I'm reading labels.
All right. I think Sailor Jerry? Is that?
Yes, Sailor Jerry spiced rum. The logo looks like a tattoo of a hula girl with a ukulele.
Oh, I think that one's obviously better one.
I mean, if I was going to drink the Jack Daniels, I should have segued from the Tennessee stuff better into it. But we're past that now, so I'm going to go with the spiced rum.
Okay. All right. I'm going to get into the case. It's a great idea. So this has nothing to do with Tennessee or beer at all, but I'm setting the scene. 1881. Cool. We're going to talk about a man named Hans Schmidt. Hans Schmidt. So he was born in a Bavarian town of Aschaffenburg, and he had a Protestant father and a Catholic mother. Both sides of his family had a long history of mental illness, Not so great. From his early childhood, Hans was regularly beaten by his father and watched his father beat his mother.
Oh,
not so great.
Very not great.
No. Even in childhood, Schmidt combined a deep religious devotion with bisexual promiscuity.
Well, that's just a good blend.
It's an awful blend.
That's a bad blend. It's a real bad blend.
And a fascination with drinking blood and dismembering animals.
Oh, that's a really bad blend.
It's an awful blend. That's a bad triangle of hobbies.
Starbucks, I would say, I don't want that blend. Give me the classic dark roast blend. I don't want this guy's blend.
This blend's like a little too bitter, a little too religious, a little too blood drinking.
Yeah, murdery, I would say.
Yeah, I agree. According to relatives, Hans once beheaded two of his parents' geese and kept the severed heads in his pocket. I wonder how big his pocket is for that to happen, but it's kind of odd.
I mean, they're just geese heads, right? They're like long and skinny. So I imagine he probably just kind of had one in either pocket and was walking around.
Well, I don't know about you, but I can't fit geese heads in my pockets.
Boy pockets, girl pockets, it's an established thing. We have big 2-liter soda bottle sized pockets. It's really unfair, honestly, but I can imagine a goose head fitting in there.
Boy pockets just have goose head shaped.
We got goose head sized holes. Yes.
Yeah. All right. So it's unfair. I guess I couldn't be that. He also frequented the village slaughterhouse daily, where he would watch the deaths and dissection of farm animals with rapt fascination.
I can't imagine anybody being fascinated by animal slaughtering. I feel like even the people who are really good at it probably go, oh, this is kind of gross.
Yeah, I mean, probably. Like, I work at a deli and I still get grossed out by our, like, ham, you know?
The meat slicer?
No, well, I don't slice the meat. That is gross, though, but I have to, like, weigh it out. And I just really don't, like, I was weighing Capicola for, like, about an hour on Monday. And it was like, I was like, this is gross. And then my coworker was like, but it's delicious. And I was like, I'm just not, I don't like how it's
kind of a spicy, salty, grease thing.
Yeah, it just stained my gloves red, and I was a little concerned about that.
That's, yeah. That's questionable. I don't like that.
So, I mean, I'm sure meat cutter, meat farm animal dissector people don't think
they're
it's
probably
cool.
Desensitized to it at some point, yeah. But probably don't think it's cool.
No, of course not. During his late seminary studies, Schmidt was arrested by the Bavarian police in 1905 and charged with forging diplomas for failing students. So that's kind of cool of him. Although the public
prosecutor... pretty nice. I would appreciate that service if you provided it to me.
No, me too. I mean, I'm not failing. But, like, I think it's a cool thing he did. Like, the two cool things about this dude is that he was bisexual and open about it in 1881. And also forged diplomas, so...
pretty groundbreaking. He's like the bad boy character from a movie, but really awful and nasty.
Yeah. If you take out like the dissecting things and the goose heads.
Well, I don't know. I'd like to see some more goose heads in the movies that I watch personally.
Oh, I mean, okay, that's you, but some of us like geese alive. although the public prosecutor of Mainz was determined to send Schmidt to prison, his father hired a lawyer who arranged for the charges to be dropped for reasons of mental defect. So let's talk about the church.
Oh, the most fun part of any conversation, the church.
Of course, we love religion here on the podcast.
My favorite thing in the world, actually.
Although all who knew him had serious doubts about his moral and mental fitness to serve as a Catholic priest, Schmidt claimed that he was ordained by Bishop Kirstein of Mainz on December 23, 1904. In later conversations with Manhattan Alienist, he recalled, quote, "The bishop ordained me alone. I do not like to speak of it. The real ordination took place the night before, St. Elizabeth. She ordained me herself. I was praying at my bedside when she appeared to me and said, 'I ordain you to the priesthood.' There was light during her appearance. I told no one. I thought it best to keep it to myself. They would make fun of me. They always made fun of me for these things. They always expect others to do as they do. God speaks to different people in different ways."
See, on one hand, that I want to believe him because of the whole, you know, I get that. I get the, well, they always laugh at me, so why would I tell anybody? But at the same time, kind of sounds like a little bit of, maybe a little bit of fabrication involved in that whole story. Maybe the entire thing, even, possibly.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not religious, so I don't believe that St. Elizabeth came to him and ordained him herself. I don't even know who she is. I'm assuming she's, like, dead. But he was ordained.
He's really old, probably.
Yeah. But he was ordained, like, in real life, so I guess, like, it doesn't really matter.
Well, yeah, somebody said he could be a priest. Somebody.
Yeah. Yeah, like after he was, like, ordained by St. Elizabeth herself, the bishop ordained him. So, I mean, I feel bad that people make fun of him, but also, like, I know what he does in the future, so I don't care.
Yeah, that's true. With hindsight, you know, kind of hard to feel bad for the guy.
Mm-hmm. Also, I was watching this show called, I think it's just called Evil. It's a weird show. It's on Netflix. It's got the guy. You've seen it? It's like this psychologist girl, or she's like an examiner for the court or whatever to find like if people are like mentally stable or not to be like tried for like crimes. But she gets hired by this priest played by the guy who plays Luke Cage. So he's hot.
Oh, he's pretty cool.
Yeah, he's pretty cool. And then, like, there's this other guy who is in, I want to say the live-action Avatar The Last Airbender movie.
Oh, well, that's a pinnacle of cinema.
I mean, of course. And, like, they go to houses and they kind of, like, disprove devil phenomenons and stuff like that. But it's interesting because there's a priest with them. But the priest dude says that he sees, like, God and angels and stuff, but he just buys shrooms and drinks it. So maybe that's what this dude was on, you know?
A little bit of early 1900s Woodstock action.
Just yeah, maybe he was just tripping.
Oh, man. Know? Midsummer. Oh, man.
Oh, man. I just wrote a 5-page essay on Midsummer. I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, we don't have to.
Next. During a parish assignment in the villages of Bergel and Seelingstadt, Schmidt molested altar boys. Sorry, I said that so casually.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sure to him it was casual because he sounds pretty horrible and awful, but...
Yeah. So Schmidt did as Catholic priests do and molested some altar boys and had affairs with several women, and consorted with prostitutes.
Great. Cool guy. Love this guy.
Meanwhile, Schmidt's creative way of saying mass and eccentric sermons led his parishioners and fellow priests to complain about him to the Monsignor and the bishop. When it became clear that no further parish assignments would be forthcoming in the Diocese of Maine, I think I said that wrong, the church that he was in, Schmidt immigrated to the United States in 1909. He was the first signed to St. John's Roman Catholic Church in Louisville, Kentucky.
Why don't we just open the doors and let him just right on in? Just let him right on in.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we were low on Catholic priests.
I feel like, I don't know, pretty hard to be low on Catholicism in the United States, but maybe that's too deep.
I mean, I don't know how easy it is to just, like, immigrate over to the United States in 1909. But he seemed to do it pretty easily as a white man.
Well, white man, church, ties, probably pretty easy.
I'd say so. So he's in Louisville, Kentucky. There, a rift with the senior pastor resulted in Schmidt's transfer to St. Boniface's Church in New York City.
New York, New York.
New York. So there, we're going to talk about a woman named Anna Amuller. I don't think I'm pronouncing that right because she's... Austro-Hungarian, so I...
Oh, you never learned your Austro-Hungarian pronunciations?
No, like, I'm not, like, yeah, like, I mean, I know some of them, obviously, as most people do.
Obviously.
But, I don't know how the double L's are pronounced, so I'm gonna say them with an L sound. I don't know if this is, like, a Spanish, it's not Spanish, I know that, but I don't know if there's a...
It's like a Lloyd or a llama. Do you think it's a Lloyd or a llama type situation, or do you
think...
Yeah,
I think it's a llama situation.
Pollo type situation.
I think it's a llama. I'm gonna do it as a llama.
I can't argue with that, so I think that's what it is.
Yeah, okay, good. In New York City, in 1912, Schmidt met a woman named Anna Amuller, the housekeeper of the rectory of St. Boniface's Church, who had immigrated from the Austro-Hungarian Empire in 1910. So she's been in the United States for 2 years. In his conversation with alienists, Schmidt claimed to have heard a voice from God ordering him to love, that's in quotes, Anna. She first refused his advances, but eventually began having a secret sexual relationship with Schmidt.
Nice. Great. Yeah.
God was like, Schmidt, fuck that girl. And Schmidt said, aye, aye, Captain. Beginning in December of 1912, Schmidt was also having a secret homosexual relationship with a New York City dentist named Ernest Moret. Or Moret.
Moret?
M-U-R-E-T.
I think Moret is really funny, so I think that's probably what it should be.
All right. Ernest Moret. We're great at names. With whom he operated a counterfeiting ring with. So he was having sex with a dentist who was also his coworker.
Who was also doing illegal counterfeiting and also a secret sexual exchange with another member of the church? This man.
Yes.
Wow. This man gets around. Gotta hand it to him, I guess.
I mean, yeah, he's just really open about it. I just thought there were rules in the Catholic Church about, you know, having sex with people, like at all.
So too. I thought it was kind of a celibacy thing for priests, but I guess not.
I mean, I think we're correct, and I think he just was like, fuck it, like literally.
Literally. Mm-hmm. He's pointed at things and he said, fuck it, and apparently he did it.
And he went for it. It was later revealed, no, sorry, I skipped a bunch of lines. Schmidt later.
I'm really taken into this story, so I hope you don't skip anything.
Schmidt later claimed that he enjoyed having sex with Moret more than Anna. So,
well, I mean,
I like to believe Schmidt was a bottom, but that's just my hot takes.
I feel like you can't. Maybe if he was a surgeon or. He would have been a top, I don't think, well, that's medical school elitism, maybe. But I'm just inclined to agree. I think you're right. He's probably a bottom.
Okay. Despite his subsequent transfer to St. Joseph's Church in Harlem, Schmidt and Anna continued a secret sexual relationship. It was
Of course, why not? Right?
I mean, I don't know how far away Harlem is from New York City, but I think it's all in New York City. So
it's like a subway. The subway exists. I don't know either.
It's just like a horse-drawn carriage ride. It's not important. They continued the relationship. It was later revealed that they were married in a secret ceremony, which Schmidt performed himself. Schmidt also wrote their names on a marriage certificate and told Anna that he was about to leave the priesthood for her, which is like the new I'm leaving my wife for you situation, you know?
Interesting.
I think it's interesting because when I first wrote that down, I really thought, I pictured like when you write your Build-A-Bear's name on the Build-A-Bear certificate and you're like, it's official. That's just how I imagine him writing their names, like with really shitty handwriting on the marriage certificate.
It says on the line where it says like the officiant, he had to come up with, he just reversed the first and last letter of his name. So it seemed like a different person.
Yeah. It was sans him. Schmidt. Yeah. Commemorative.
I think it's interesting because the I'm leaving the church for you thing ties into the thing I'm going to talk about.
Awesome. Fantastic. I love these comparisons you can make.
The parallels are forming, kind of. Not really, but kind of.
During a sexual encounter with Anna on the high altar of St. Joseph's Church, which sounds scandalous to me, Schmidt received what he claimed was a command from God to sacrifice her. The command was repeated so insistently that Schmidt told Anna, and she said, "You're crazy."
As you do, of course.
Yeah. So soon after that,
I think that if somebody said they wanted to sacrifice me, I would tell them they were crazy.
No, probably. I agree. Like, I want to imagine that they're like having sex on the high altar in this church, which I just feel like it's like a pedestal type situation. And he just goes, "Hey, Anna," like while in the middle, and he goes, "God says I gotta sacrifice you," and she goes, "Okay, you're kind of crazy," and then they just proceed with whatever they were doing.
That. I just want to know why God is just kind of hanging out and they're going, hey, dude, you should kill her. Hey, dude, kill her. Go ahead. Do it.
I dare you. I double dog dare you.
Triple dog dare you. You won't.
What are you, a pussy? Do it.
Do it.
Soon after that, Anna informed him that she was pregnant. And then on the night of September 2nd, 1913, Schmidt went to the apartment that they had rented while posing as a married couple. And slashed Anna's throat while she slept. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. He drank her blood.
I, from what I understand about ritual sort of sacrifice, kind of just cutting their throat while they're asleep doesn't sound super like it's like a very honorable sacrifice. But, I mean, I don't know. Maybe God told him to sneak up on her.
God was like, "Here's what I need you to do. I need you to come at her while she is fucking passed out. And if you could just slice her throat, drink the blood maybe, I don't know." And then he's like whispering to his disciples or whatever. He's like, "You know what else would be cool? If you cut her body up. How about that one? And don't tell anyone about this. Peace out, sucker." Anyway, so he drank her blood and then he raped her as she bled to death.
Oh, wow. Classy
yeah. guy. And then he dismembered her body and threw the pieces from a ferry into the Hudson River.
Clever. That's some real early 1900s ingenuity right there.
Right.
That's not many people were like, "Ooh, the ferry." I want to know who's throwing things off of a ferry and we're like, "That seems normal."
Large bloody pieces off of a ferry and they're like, "Uh-huh. That's New York, fine. Baby.
That's New York."
Schmidt then returned to St. Joseph's Church, offered mass and administered Holy Communion as though nothing had happened.
Well, yeah, so, I mean, I feel like it would be a little bit weird if he acted as something had happened.
I mean, I guess, unless he wanted to be like, "By the way, God told me to sacrifice someone and I did, so you could say that I'm probably his favorite priest," or whatever, you know?
I'm basically a demigod now because I killed someone, basically. Yeah,
basically. So don't, I think I should just be made a saint.
Like behavior this guy has been presenting so far, I gotta say.
So we're gonna jump into the police investigation for this. So after pieces of Anna's torso washed up ashore at Cliffside Park and Weehawken, New Jersey, Hudson County Police detectives found a price tag still attached to the pillowcase used to wrap one of her body parts. First of all, what kind of psycho doesn't take the tags off? But
not super careful. Not a smart move on his part.
Yeah, well,
don't those like brush against your cheek when you're sleeping, man? Wouldn't that bother you?
I think it would bother. Yeah, it's not even like that he didn't take it off because he buried it, like he threw a body with it into the ocean or water. But it's just like he sleeps with the price tag still on his pillowcases, which is like,
ugh, what a
psycho.
That's
some psycho behavior. Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Should have kind of
weird. So they used the tag and the pillowcase to trace it back to a Newark factory, which sold exclusively to Manhattan furniture dealer George Sachs. The investigation was then taken over by the New York City Police Department and assigned to Manhattan Chief of Detective Joseph Farrow. Or Farrat, if we want to be fancy about it.
Man, we're just really finding all the hard names this episode, aren't we?
Yeah. So after arriving at George Sachs Furniture Store at 2782 8th Avenue, Inspector Farrat found the dealer unable to recall how many of the pillowcases he had sold. A check through his receipts revealed that a bed spring, a mattress, pillows, and pillowcases had been sold on August 26, 1913. The buyer had given the name A. Van Dyke and had arranged for his purchases to be delivered to a third-story apartment at 68 Broadhurst Avenue. Question.
Not super careful.
No, well, I mean, he used a fake name, but
fake address might have been smart, too.
Well, I think, to be fair, I think he bought all that stuff, you know, just to furnish his apartment.
Yeah, I guess, but if you're trying to fly under the radar, telling your furniture delivery people what your address is not very careful.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I agree. So they questioned the building superintendent, and they revealed that the apartment was occupied by a married couple, and the husband was described as a man with a heavy German accent who had given his name as H. Schmidt. When a three-day stake out revealed no one arriving, Inspector Farrow ordered Detective Frank Casasa to break into the apartment. A cursory search.
Police tactics. Just break in.
just bust it down, man. Like, all they have is the fact that, like, someone
bought pillowcases.
Yeah. A cursory search found that the door had been recently scrubbed. Oh, sorry, that the floor had been recently scrubbed, but large amounts of dry blood were found on the walls. A large blood-stained knife was also found on the kitchen shelf. Men's clothing with the name A. Van Dyke sewn into the lining was found, as were letters in both German and English addressed to Hans Schmidt. Many of the letters were from women in Germany. The largest number, however, were from Anna Amuller, whose most recent address was listed at 428 East 17th Street. Inspector Farrow and Detective Casasa and O'Connell visited the address and learned that Anna had moved out after receiving a job as a housekeeper at St. Boniface's Church. Farrow and the detectives then visited St. Boniface's Church and were told by the senior pastor, Father John Braun, that Anna had been his housekeeper but had transferred to St. Joseph's Church. Upon being asked if he knew the name Hans Schmidt, Father Braun described him as a priest who had formerly been assigned to St. Boniface's Church, but had also moved to St. Joseph's. Inspector Farrow and Detectives Casasas and O'Connell arrived at St. Joseph's Rectory at 1:30. After Farrow pounded on the door, the senior pastor, Father Daniel Quinn, opened the door, led them into the parlor, and woke Schmidt. Upon being confronted by the inspector and the detectives, Schmidt admitted, quote, "I killed her. I killed her because I love her." Schmidt then described the murder and dismemberment in detail.
Wow.
He did this all.
I wasn't expecting that, I gotta be honest.
Yeah, he was just like, well, since you're here, I did in fact kill her. Here's how.
I guess all this talk I've been given of, well, I wasn't very careful. I mean, maybe he wanted to get caught.
Yeah, I mean, maybe.
Known for his sacrifice.
Yeah, under God's eye and also the city of New York. As his fellow priests watched in horror, Schmidt was taken into police custody. So time to get into the trial. So following his arrest, the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of New York, I can't pronounce words, of New York announced that Father Schmidt's priest faculties had been indefinitely suspended.
I think that's a good first step. I think they're moving in the right direction with that one.
I agree.
Probably should go to jail too, though. Probably.
Who should?
He should. I mean, he should probably go to jail.
Yeah. No, I agree. During Schmidt's first trial, Schmidt feigned insanity. On the top of his defense team, using Schmidt's claim of hearing voices to try to convince the jury of their client's insanity, the defense also claimed that insanity ran in Schmidt's family. They called one witness, a psychologist named Smith Ellie Jelliffe, to testify that Schmidt's family tree showed up to 60 near or distant relatives who displayed signs of mental instability, and therefore Schmidt could not be put to death because he too was insane. The prosecution called in other witnesses, including doctors, who had examined Schmidt while he awaited trial and concluded that contrary to his efforts to convince authorities otherwise and contrary to Schmidt's ramblings about voices telling him to commit murder against Anna, Schmidt was, in fact, sane. However, the prosecution's efforts were in vain. At the conclusion of the trial in December of 1913, the jury could not come to a decision after deliberating for several days. So he had a hung jury. So another trial. Isn't that crazy how that just happens?
I'm not gonna lie, I'm kind of with the jury on this one, because he does sound like maybe he's a little bit crazy, but at the same time, he could be putting on a big old show for everybody.
He could be, and that might be part of the fact that he said, I killed her, you know? Maybe he was like, well, now that I'm caught, time to act wacky. So the second trial occurred approximately 2 weeks later. This time, however, the prosecution introduced testimony that, in April of 1913, well before Father Schmidt received his alleged command from God to sacrifice Anna, he had convinced a woman named Bertha Zeck to pose as Anna Amuler and to purchase a $5,000 life insurance policy under her name.
Oh, very cool. Always with the life insurance in these murdery things, huh?
Everyone's out for money, man.
People can't be down for just, you know, they can't be stopped at just the murder part. They're like, oh, I'm going to make a buck off of it too, because why not?
Yeah, money's always the downfall of murderers, you know?
Well, it's the downfall of a lot of people, too. You know?
That's true. It's not
murderers.
Great.
Murderers are just... Murderers are people, too. No, I can't say that. Murderers aren't really...
Murderers are bad people. They are, in fact, people.
Very bad people.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, of course. Anyway, so the policy listed Schmidt as a sole beneficiary. On February 5th, 1914, after 3 hours of deliberation, a jury found Schmidt guilty of first-degree murder, and he was sentenced to death. After being sentenced, Schmidt said, quote, I am satisfied with the verdict. I would rather die today than tomorrow. So, I mean.
Gotta give him some credit there.
Yeah, I mean, who wants to chill in prison when you could just
die?
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense, I guess. I don't know. I heard prison's kind of okay. I mean, not really. I haven't heard that it's okay at all.
Probably not for him, I would say.
No, probably not. So Schmidt's defense team filed an appeal shortly after his sentence, which postponed his execution for at least a year while it worked its way through the courts. In December of 1914, Schmidt admitted that he feigned insanity during his trial. In admitting so, however, he also pinned the murders on the dentist with whom he had a homosexual affair, Ernest Moret. He said, I'm not
into this.
I was in fact faking it, but my gay lover, the dentist from New York City, did kill her.
Not very cool, Schmidt.
No, kind of lame of him, to be honest. He didn't have to say that about
Ernest.
His lover
just scammed some people. I mean, that's not super cool, but at the same time, at least he, you know, didn't actually kill somebody.
Mm-hmm. So Dr. Moret, Schmidt alleged, had accidentally killed Anna during a botched abortion.
Accidentally slit her throat and then dismembered the body, I assume.
You know, how we accidentally do that. I wonder if that's the thought process behind season one of American Horror Story, when that dentist killed that girl during a botched abortion. It wasn't a botched abortion. He was raping her. Never mind. Take everything I've said back.
I forgot about that.
Yeah. He was also giving a board. It was a different guy. Never mind. Schmidt further claimed that he allowed authorities to pursue him for the murder rather than Moret because he wanted to cover for his friend. but I guess he took that back after finding out that he was going to get killed. Schmidt's appeal was ultimately unsuccessful. And then on the early morning of February 18th, 1916, Schmidt entered the death chamber at 5:50 a.m. Moments before being seated in the electric chair, Schmidt said, quote, "I want to say one word before I go. I beg forgiveness of all I have offended or scandalized, and I forgive all who have offended against me." Exclamation point.
Well, that's nice of him, I guess.
Kind of, but it also kind of sounds like he's like, "I'm sorry that I hurt your feelings." Like, he's like, "I'm sorry that what I said offended you," you know?
A little bit of a light apology for a murderer.
Yeah, he should have been like, "I am sorry that I murdered people and molested, like, children," and, you know, was overall a pretty bad person.
I forgot about that. That was all pre-USA.
Yeah.
Really nasty guy.
Yeah, he's not great. He's bad in pretty much every way. So then moments before the switch was thrown on the electric chair to kill him, he said in a muffled voice, quote, "My last word is to say goodbye to my dear old mother," end quote. The first jolt of electricity was initiated at 5:52 a.m., and then after two additional jolts were administered, the prison physical pronounced Hans Schmidt dead at 5:58 a.m. A reporter from the Albany Times later wrote, quote, "His last night on earth, he spent proclaiming his innocence and declaring that he had made peace with God. The guards had expected a scene when the slayer was to be executed, but his actions surprised them. He was the coolest man in the death chamber. He almost domineered those who assisted in putting him to death." Schmidt's family had originally intended to ship Schmidt's body home to Germany. However, due to an ongoing World War I, they couldn't do
that.
Due to the world war that was happening in that area, they couldn't ship him back. So Father William Cashin and the Sing Sing prison Roman Catholic chaplain arranged for his burial in New York State. And at the request of Schmidt's family in Germany, the location of his burial was kept secret. So we cannot
probably
go and visit his
grave.
Yeah, I think so. So there are some other possible crimes that he could have been responsible
for. Just tossing him there on the side, just kind of peppering him in.
So apart from killing his young pregnant wife, wife's in quotations, further investigation revealed that Schmidt had a second apartment where he set up a counterfeiting workshop, as we know. Authorities also suspected Schmidt of the murder of Alma Kellner, who was 9 years old, whose body was found buried in the basement of St. John's Church in Louisville, Kentucky, where Schmidt had previously worked.
Huh, what a bastard.
Yeah. So her body had been burned, but authorities suspected the killer had initially tried to dismember her, which is what Schmidt did. The janitor, Joseph Wendling, was convicted and sentenced to life in prison for the murder based on circumstantial evidence and bloody clothing found at his house. So he might have done it. It might have been a Freddy Krueger situation. But Schmidt could have also done it because he, you know, liked to dismember people.
And murderer. Work with them. Yeah.
Yeah. The end. That's my story.
Well, that was Maggie, no offense. I like your stories, but that was a pretty bad story. That got kind of stuck.
I know, it was a little dark there at times, but I think it had a pretty happy ending.
He did die at the end.
Yeah, he died. So that was great.
I like that part. I like that part. Mm-hmm. So you told me to find something to do with the case. But you didn't tell me anything about the case before we started talking. So the first thing that I thought of when I was trying to think of scandalous priest stories was Fleabag, the British comedy series. Mm-hmm. I have to say, a lot less murder in that series, and the priest is definitely not responsible for any murders in that series. But I think that the characters are kind of interesting parallels, even, a little bit.
All right. Elaborate.
Well, so there's basically two main characters in at least the second season of the show, where the most kind of story development happens, and that's the priest and Fleabag. And Fleabag is a young woman who has suffered through recently the death of her best friend, which may or may not have been her fault. Spoiler, it kind of was. And she is engaging.
I've only seen like three episodes, but didn't she, this is a full spoiler, did she sleep with her best friend's boyfriend or something like that?
He did do that, yes. And then her best friend committed suicide because of it.
Yeah, there we go. I knew it.
So she's grappling with that guilt for the whole series. And the priest is kind of her, she engages in a lot of self-destructive, even self-pitying kind of behavior. The priest is one of her unhealthy coping mechanisms, where she meets this priest who is, I believe, officiating her sister's wedding or something. It's been a long time since I saw her first season. But she meets this priest, and he is played by, what's his name? You know who it is. He was in the Harry Potter, I think. Yes, he's the Andrew Scott man. That's who he is. Andrew Scott. I think he was in Supernatural or something. I'm not sure. I don't know drama shows.
Did you just call Supernatural a drama show?
He's the priest, and so he's supposed to be this kind of goofy, loosey-goosey priest who's very suave and charming. And he is, when they meet, he is committed to celibacy and has kicked an alcohol addiction, but through their time hanging out,
his picture just came up. He was in Sherlock. He played Moriarty.
Oh, that's, you're right. They all kind of blend together, don't they?
Yeah, they do. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She kind of breaks him down and convinces him. I mean, there's some bad blood on both sides of the, bad intentions on both sides of the argument, but she kind of breaks him down and convinces him to abandon some of his principles for her, to the point where he even debates leaving the church to be with her. And there's a big blow-up argument towards the end of the series, and then they reconcile, and he kind of basically, the finale of the second season, major spoiler territory, is that they agree that there cannot be anything between them, and he has to be his own man, and that she's not good for him. So Fleabag is a pretty intense story of real human emotion and how people actually behave, and how it's not necessarily always their fault. People are victims of circumstance, but lash out in toxic ways and need to have growth and development. So not quite as cut and dry as man was kind of crazy and murdered his pregnant girlfriend. However, I can kind of see the emotions boiling over in a slightly different way to what happened. Maybe if they hadn't been such, if everybody involved hadn't been in their own way, come to maturity and resolve the situation like adults, perhaps something terrible could have happened.
Yeah. Like he killed her.
Like he killed her. Like he said, okay, Fleabag, I'm going to kill you. Mm-hmm. I think he was portrayed as violent at multiple points in the show. And so I can imagine a dark, dark, horror-y show of Fleabag where the priest has to, I don't know, kill her and dismember her body and hide her in the Hudson River. Phoebe Waller-Bridge is, she plays the titular Fleabag and also wrote and directed a lot of the show. And I honestly could see her doing a show about this case. I mean, it's the sense of really awful, dark themes and the kind of bizarre comedy and all of it. Yeah, I do think it lends itself pretty well to Fleabag. That I had more specific examples to call from in my brain, but
I mean, honestly, that's a fantastic comparison. I'm actually looking at the Wikipedia page, and I'm hovering over Phoebe Mary Waller Bridges or whatever, and she's a head writer on Killing Eve, which is cool because that's a murdery show.
I haven't seen Killing Eve.
Oh, I think you'd like it. You should watch it. It's
I will watch it.
It's very good. It's a funny show too. It's also a dark comedy. I would say. I mean, I don't know if
I'm
it's
a
that
fan
comedic
of dark comedies. Like I mentioned to you before we started, the only other thing that came to mind when I thought of stories with really awful priests was one that's not about a priest at all, which is In Bruges. A very terribly dark comedy about a hitman, which isn't the subject of today's discussion, so we'll save that for another episode if you ever cover a hitman story.
Oh, I'm sure I will at some point. I'll call you back on.
There's a lot of people murdering people.
Yeah.
A lot of people murdering in the world.
All the time, really. Like, I sometimes talk to my father about it because I call my parents on Sundays so that they know that I'm not dead. And
that's a good point.
Yeah. And so sometimes I record on Sunday, so I tell my father a little bit about the case that I'm doing. And he always is like, did you hear in Jupiter someone killed someone because their dog was barking or something like that? I'm like, what? Who? When?
That's
like recent.
Florida. It sounds a lot like Florida.
I mean, yeah. I think a dog bit someone or something, so they like went over to his house and killed them. But
here
he's
in
always
Murfreesboro,
here.
We just had someone. The police just discovered somebody was chained up in a murder couple's basement. They were a husband and wife murder team. So that's pretty cool. These things actually happen. Sometimes we read these cases and I go, wow, that guy, that's pretty crazy. And we talk about a TV show right after it and I go, ha. And my brain kind of goes, maybe this guy was a TV show, but no, that's pretty crazy real life stuff. I can't, humans are weird.
No, I know. It's so scary. Sometimes, like, now that it's, like, dark out up in Rochester, like, if the sun sets at, like, 7, like, I'll walk to my car.
Yeah, I'm looking at my window. It's 6:30 here in Tennessee, and it's dark outside.
Yeah, like, I'll walk to my car at night from my film class, now that I have a car, and I'm like, someone could just fucking kill me in this empty parking lot, like, right now.
Right now.
It's crazy.
They just yoink me. See, I work at a moving company, and sometimes we end the day at, like, storage units at, like, 10 o'clock at night in the middle of nowhere, and I'm like, boy, if all three of us were to just disappear right now, I don't know who would notice, except for our managers when we didn't show up to work the next day.
And me, who's like, where's Dante? We were supposed to record, you know?
That would be great if I happened to go missing on the very day you were supposed to record Screen of the Crime. That'd be
it could happen.
Eventually, that would be a great episode for you.
Yeah.
Eventually. Probably not right the day after, but.
Yeah, it's mentioned a lot, actually, within the group of people that I speak to about my podcast. Like, you know, when I, like, talk shit about people or something, and they're like, you need me to kill them? That could make a good episode for your podcast. It's like, I don't think I want to talk about my friends dying.
I don't even want you to be the subject of my podcast, actually. Thanks.
It's like, I would prefer not to talk about you.
Most of the people I talk about are also dead. So maybe don't end up on my podcast.
It's like, if you could actually stay away. Yeah, no, you're alive because you're my guest. So, and you have to stay alive.
I don't have a track record of dying.
So far, none of my guests have died.
Oh, well, that's great. That's a weight off my chest.
I mean, some of them I haven't spoken to in a little while, so.
Probably not.
Yeah, probably not. Like, chances are, nah. So not, it's pretty good right now.
Good track record.
Great track record, honestly.
But if you do ever start running out of material, you could be a serial killer.
That's true.
And then you just record a podcast episode about everybody you kill and really throw them off the scent. Be like, wow, this person got killed. And the police will be like, I didn't even know that yet. How do you know?
You know what's crazy is that that's the plot of season one of the Scream TV series.
Somebody is just killing people and then posting about it and they don't get caught because people just think they're a weirdo?
Well, so Bella Thorne dies, right? And there's a podcaster. She's a true crime podcaster. She comes to town. Her name is Piper. And she's like interviewing the students and asking about like the murders and people keep dying. Spoiler for Scream season one. She's the murderer.
The podcaster.
The podcaster. Yeah.
I don't know, man.
She's like the daughter of the original like guy who like had a murder spree like 25 years before or whatever.
One of those family murder family kind of thing.
Yeah, it is. But she's a podcast. She's a true crime podcaster. Podcasting about the murders she is in fact committing. So there's that, but there's also a movie on Hulu. It's under the Huluween category. It's called Tragedy Girls, I think, and it's starring the lesbian girl from Deadpool. She's in Trinkets, and I think it's these duo girls who end up like killing people to get popularity or something like that. I haven't seen it. I think that's the plot of it.
Well, there's that movie that we watched a long time ago. I don't remember the name of it, where they were like doing stunts to kill to earn points, and they ended up having to kill people.
Was it Nerve?
That's it. That's
Machine Gun Kelly's Nerve. Best work.
Machine Gun Kelly is maybe, I don't know, maybe one of the biggest actors of our time, I would say. One of the greatest actors alive right now, perhaps.
I think Machine Gun Kelly is an amazing actor. I really love him. He was in Nerve, and he was in The Bird Box. And he's in,
actually...
I didn't
even know he was in The Bird Box.
Yeah, he was the dude that has sex with the cop, and then they run away with the car.
That's cool for him.
That is cool for him, but he was in a TV show, which I've recommended to you, because you were kind of a roadie, called Roadies, which I recently started up again, and he plays, I don't remember his name, he's like the brother of one of the main girls, and he's the babysitter of one of the singer's kids, but he's like basically just Machine Gun Kelly. He's like really into music, and it's like, he's like a main character kind of, and it's a great role. I didn't realize it was Machine Gun Kelly until later, but he's a good actor. Like, I know that he's like a musician and he's got that song out with Halsey, but if he ever wanted to pursue a career in acting, I'd really be down to like
to network. You should talk to him.
I can be your new manager, Machine Gun Kelly, if that's,
you know,
what you're interested
in. I have a friend who did a music video for him, so maybe I can put you guys in touch, and you can network with the guy who shot secondary behind the scenes footage for a Machine Gun Kelly music video.
You know, I've been thinking a lot about future careers, because I'll have an MBA, but that means absolutely nothing if I can't get a job. And I follow a lot of Instagrams for like Netflix shows, like recently Julian the Phantom's Instagram page. I think I followed like, I watch shows, The Haunting of Hill Houses or something like that. And
I just started watching The Haunting of Bly Manor.
Me too. We love Owen. We were talking about that in our friend group chat.
Gosh, we love Owen so very much.
He's so nice.
I kind of want to marry Owen, not going to lie.
He's such a lovely man, and he's the coroner from iZombie.
It's Raul Coley. Yes, he was on iZombie, and I think that show is underrated.
I do too. I think iZombie, I enjoyed it for the time that I watched it. I never finished it, but it was a pretty good show.
You know, I don't think I finished it either. But in terms of the things that the CW releases, iZombie was maybe my favorite CW show of recent years.
I think I can get behind that. I can't recall any good shows that the CW has really made.
What, Maggie? You don't appreciate the cinematic masterpiece that is Riverdale?
I mean, I think if Riverdale wasn't... I liked the first episode of Riverdale, and I will stand by that.
Pretty good. The first episode is pretty good, and then you watch the second episode, and you go,
Yeah, the first episode, you're like, ooh, a murder mystery? Like, I was, like, down for that. And then it really just didn't.
It could have been a really good movie, but it just doesn't make a very good TV show.
I agree. I mean, the way they took it made it an even worse TV show, especially with their musical episodes. I wasn't.
There are musical episodes in Riverdale?
Yeah, you didn't know. They do one Heathers, and I think they do... Oh, I don't know the name of the musical, but it's about some person that dresses... It's like a drag queen situation.
Oh, musical. Is it... The one about the desert? Queen of the Desert? I don't know.
No, I just know that I haven't seen it in the episode. The one gay character that's a man. There's multiple. I don't know why I said that. The main one. I think his name's Kyle or Kevin.
Kevin
dresses in full drag or whatever and like sings a song. It might not be about drag, but he was definitely in drag. And the principal was like, "You can't perform that because I'm homophobic or something." And they put
tackling
on this whole.
Issues,
oh, it's called Hedwig.
Hedwig in the Angry Inch.
Sure, yes. I knew Hedwig was part of it. So, yeah, no, Riverdale's not great.
Well, we've accidentally, as is the case on a lot of true crime shows, we've accidentally started talking about Riverdale. I feel like this is a running theme.
Oh no, we have to pull it back. Let's go back to Bly Manor. I watched episode 5 while I was doing my women and gender studies homework, which is god awful. And episode 5, I don't want to spoil anything, but it's like the episode that focuses on the housekeeper.
Oh, I just watched that one. That was a great episode.
It was a good episode, but I honest to God felt like I was having a stroke through half of it.
Yeah, kind of same. The flashbacks were a little bit hard to keep track of.
Yeah, I was confused as to when we were, because like she kept going like present time kind of, and I was like, I guessed it. I guessed what was happening with her like immediately. I was like, oh, I got it. But I thought it was really cool with her interview with Owen. He like broke it. He was like, why are we, like, she was like, why are we doing this again? He's like, why are we? You know, like, I thought that was cool. It really got me.
I know I said this disingenuously about another actor recently, but I do believe that Raoul Coley, I don't know, this is almost an Emmy-ish performance to me from him. He's kind of nailing it. And this show has a lot of, I would say, Emmy-worthy performances so far. I'm really enjoying.
I agree completely.
I'm really enjoying, what's her name? The main character, Dani.
Yeah.
I'm really enjoying her. I like her kind of American, very like 80s American quirks.
I love her voice because she's in You as well. And she does a very high-pitched voice kind of in Bly Manor. And I love it. I like, because whenever she talks, I'm kind of like shook a little bit because of how she sounds. But I she's a great actress. I think she's doing amazing things. I'm really happy she was in the second season because as far as I'm aware, there's like 4 actors that have transferred over as far as I've seen.
I only saw the first episode of Hill House, so I couldn't even tell you.
You haven't seen The Haunting of Hill House?
No, I'm watching Bly Manor first because Raoul Coley's in it and I love everything he touches.
You should watch Hill House as well. It doesn't matter because they're anthologies, but Hill House is
spectacular. That's what I read. That's why I started with it. I've heard nothing but good things about Hill House. I have been off of horror recently, but then I did a little Hereditary Midsummer double feature,
mm-hmm.
and I said, I'm in the mood for artsy horror movies. So I decided I was going to watch Hill House, and then I was reading. I did that this weekend. I watched the first episode this weekend, and then it just popped into like my socials feed and people were talking about Raoul and saying that he was in this show, Bly Manor. So I was like, well, can I skip the first season? And then I realized to my wonderful surprise that it's an anthology series. And I love anthology shows. I think they're a lot of fun. I think it helps things stay fresh.
No, I agree because we tend to like watch shows because we like actors, or at least I like actors. But sometimes a series can like start going downhill. But like when it's an anthology, like even American Horror Story, you're like, who's Evan Peters playing this season? Kind of, you know?
I really loved, I think, the first 3 seasons of that show or maybe 4. And I kind of fell off around Coven. But I remember really liking Hotel and Murder House and what's the other one? Not Freak Show. Freak Show was kind
of Asylum.
Asylum was really interesting. I like Zachary Quinto.
Me too. I think Murder House is my all-time favorite. You can't take me away from that. The second season's Asylum. I thought it was okay. I'm not really into religious things. But like it was pretty good. I liked Coven. I thought it was kind of like a more chilled version of it. I didn't like what they did with Evan Peters' character, but overall I really like Emma Roberts, so I liked her part in that. And then I was recently watching Hotel again. It's so incredibly sexual, which is...
It's very sexual. It is. But like,
I rewatched episode 1, and Schmidt from New Girl just fucking actress, gets killed by the ass rape demon. It's awful.
Yeah, didn't last very long in that show.
No, they don't. But I really like the cinematography in Hotel. They use a lot of fisheye lenses and stuff like that.
Hotel
and I like
is very pretty, very like The Shining adjacent. obviously.
Yeah. Speaking of The Shining, Ryan Murphy has a new show out called Ratched, I think. The first Ratched, shot,
yes.
I don't know if it's the first shot, but there's a shot of her buggy driving on like a mountain cliff, and it is literally just pulled directly out of The Shining. And then she like walks into this, and there's like a bathroom scene. I'm like, someone watched The Shining recently and thought, hey, I should do this, which, I mean, go for it. I mean, it's amazing. Yeah, I love that type of situation.
Every time I see The Shining, I think, I should go for this. I haven't seen the Doctor Sleep yet either, but I've heard good things about it.
I saw it in theaters. It's great. A lot of crossfades, which is kind of weird. That's what I noticed. it was literally, I think it was the last film I saw in theaters, which is kind of sad to think about. But it was good. I love the plot. It's incredibly long. It's not as good as The Shining by any means, but it pays homage to The Shining a lot. From what I've seen in videos, it's kind of a cross between what happens in the book and The Shining. Like it's like a sequel to The Shining movie, because I didn't follow the book, and then also sort of takes what happens in the Dr. Sleep books. So I think he did it well. I mean, I haven't read the book, so I'm not certain, but I think it was a good conclusion to The Shining series as a whole. So I like
it. Well, I've been avoiding Stephen King content because I feel like a lot of it has been subpar recently, but I guess I'll go watch that whenever it comes out on streaming.
It's on Spectrum. I don't know if you have Spectrum.
I don't have television.
No.
Unfortunately. I wish I did.
I heard, speaking of Stephen King content, we're going off various ropes here.
Way off book, but that's okay. We're just talking about murdery things. And that's in the spirit.
There's The Stand TV series coming out. And it's got a bunch of big stars.
Seen a trailer for that.
Yeah, there's a really like vague trailer out about it, but it's got a lot of stars in it. I'm kind of excited. I haven't read the book because the book is like the width of my body, so
it is a very long. Stephen King was like, he cracked his knuckles and he was like, okay, how long can I make a book?
Yeah, and especially because I work all the time, but I work in a job where I can't wear headphones anymore, so I can't really get into audio type situations. Yeah, and I'm not gonna read a book. I don't even have time for that ever. So I was trying to read a book called, I think it was We Were Liars or something like that, because they were making a TV show out of it, and I got like one chapter in and I was like, I don't have time for this, and then the book expired. I had to return it, and that's
sad. Never ever once tried an audiobook. I always told myself whenever I ran out of podcasts to listen to, I would start getting into audiobooks, and then this year happened, and now everybody has a podcast, except for me, apparently. And so there's all this really beautiful content, really wonderful content that my friends are making and my favorite creators are making. So now audiobooks have been pushed by the wayside again. And I kind of feel bad about that because I don't really read anymore.
I feel exactly the same way, and I've spoken to a lot of people. A lot of people our age haven't been reading a lot. I don't think I can actually fully, like, for women in gender studies, we have to read, like, 300-page articles, and, like, I just can't do that. Like, I can't read anymore.
I have never found myself with the time to sit down with a book and be honest.
Yeah, I agree completely. I used to listen to a lot of BookTubers who would read full books for me in like the span of 2 days, and then they'd review them. And I'm like, that's so great. And now I get to hear about this book in an hour and 45 minutes, you know, really condensed. And that's so nice.
When I was in like early high school, I could rock through like 2 books, 3 books in a day if I set my mind to it. And now if I tried to sit down with a book, a singular book, I don't know if I could do it all in one sitting.
I agree, and I don't know if it's, like, my lack of time or my lack of focus, or, like, I'm constantly have this feeling like I need to be doing something else than enjoying my life, you know? Because, maybe, like, what?
To bring it back around.
Yes.
Maybe we're just way too cool, and we're super Gen Z, and books are lame and old, and we'd rather listen to new media.
Maybe. I mean, to be fair,
books are just old people stuff, you know? And we're not old. We're cool, young, hip.
Currently, I'm learning about Princess Diana, which I would never have picked up a book about, but I find it so incredibly interesting. So, yes, I wish I could read more. I really loved reading Gone Girl, and I didn't love reading Ready Player One, but I read it via audiobook. But I think podcasts give you a lot more information in such shorter time.
Personalized. It can be more topical and personalized to the times going on in the world.
No, I agree. And it's like, it's kind of like reading like a news article or something, but like not, because it's not like current events, but it's like these, especially with You're Wrong About, because they're journalists and one of them's writing a book on satanic panic. So she's really interested in true crime. And the other guy, I think works for like the Huffington Post or something like that. They like have distinct points of views and they research these things like so intensely, like their 100th episode just came out. And he was talking about his first podcast notes were like 50 pages long. And now his podcast notes are like 500 pages long, which is so amazing. Cause it's like, instead of like writing articles that I would read about, they're saying it to me and they're bringing their own like personalities and point of views and thoughts to it, which I can enjoy because now I'm getting two opinions on one subject. I'm not reading it.
I find it's a lot easier to absorb information when it's presented almost conversationally, where it feels like you're listening to somebody tell a story as opposed to trying to pull words off of a page and gain. And I mean, there are a lot of talented writers out there who can really deliver some stories that keep you gripped and you come away from it with a lasting impact. But I find too often that like I'll be reading news stories and somebody goes, oh, what are you reading about? And I'll just be like, oh, I don't even know. I'm just kind of scrolling through. But with a podcast, there's a lot of things that I've learned from, like I've listened, and I just love the kind of diversity of how many different podcasts are out there right now. Mm-hmm. Like there's one that I really love called Ono, Ross, and Carrie, which is these two, I guess they're kind of journalists, but they basically do deep dives on like cults and pseudoscience and things that people are kind of curious about, and they do it so that you don't have to, is the motto of their podcast. So they've done episodes on Scientology and on like astrology and crystal healing and even like Soylent, the meal replacement beverage that people were kind of skeptical if it actually worked for the first little while. It's very interesting to be able to sit in my car and on the way home, like learn about something like that. And I feel like a book you might be able to, is a book is a great deep dive on information, but I can't listen to a whole book on my car ride home. And I would just end up having to like scatter it over multiple days. I don't know. We've gone off the rails totally, but I'm on a podcast. This is my first time on a podcast, so I figured it would be nice to talk about how cool podcasts are and how I don't quite agree with this attitude of like, oh, everybody's got a podcast now, because I think it's the new way that people are learning.
No, I agree completely. And I mean, I think my podcast, to speak about myself, isn't as much as an educational podcast, but more of like a fun podcast, because like I listen to podcasts like My Favorite Murder and That's Why We Drink, not like to deep dive into a fucking priest that murders people, but to like feel like I'm involved in these conversations and like I learn about these people and I like these people and I want to know what's going on with their lives. And like, especially with And That's Why We Drink, like the one of the hosts got married and I was like, that's so great. Right. Like, you feel like you're part of it. And when you're reading a book, I don't know, like I just don't, it's, I think a lot, you really like get to know these people.
Exactly. It's you kind of almost, it's like you're sitting in a room with your friends listening to them go, oh my God, you know what I just heard about, as opposed to reading a book that people put a lot of time and effort into and can give you a really good like vision of exactly the details of something. And they're valuable, books are valuable, audiobooks even are valuable to that degree, but I have no attention span, so I like listening to people make goofy jokes about murders while also telling me this guy is a murderer.
Yeah, no, yeah, I agree completely. And that's why, I mean, I don't know what my viewers and my listeners think about it, but like that's why I like to talk sometimes about myself, about what I'm watching, and so people might like me, might think that they're interested in the same things as me, and they're like, oh, well, I know someone who's watching like The Haunting of Hill House or something like that. Maybe I should watch it.
Kind of a like a it feels so much more personal. And like when a podcaster makes a movie recommendation, I'm like, oh, if they like it, maybe I'll like it.
Yeah, because if you're listening to what I choose to talk about on a weekly basis, we got something in common. You know what I mean?
Similar interests going on.
Yeah, so I think that's cool. I really like podcasts just because I like educating myself. I watch like YouTube videos on why movies are important and things, but like that's not like what I'm studying at all in any way, shape, or form. But I like to just like know factoids because I like to feel educated. So
I just really appreciate the way media has changed and been made more available. I've been watching this guy on YouTube, speaking of slightly educational things. I think Jim Can't Swim, JCS, he does psychological evaluations of interrogation room videos for murderers, kidnappers, petty criminals, where he talks about the psychology and the science behind interviews and behind eliciting confessions. And he did one recently about how it can be used to trap people into giving false confessions, and how humans react when they're being truthful versus when they're lying. And it's just very interesting, and I love that that kind of thing exists, because I don't know if I ever would have gone to the library and picked up a book on criminal psychological evaluations. I mean, that's kind of a niche thing, but presented to me in my YouTube suggested box with a catchy title and a eye-catching thumbnail, you go, ooh, what's this? And you listen to a guy for an hour and a half talk about Casey Anthony, and you come out of it on the other side having watched and listened to the whole thing going, oh my God, wow. And you get to form these opinions about like these current events or not so current, and I just really appreciate the level of self-expression that this kind of medium allows people.
Yeah, I agree. It allows us to, like, if you're going to pick up a book about something, you have to be fully invested in that subject. But like now with podcasts that are like visit a random topic every week, or with YouTube videos that like do random stuff like Crash Course, you can be like, well, for the next hour, I'm going to learn about this, you know, and it doesn't affect your life really, but now you're coming away with those ideas and you might be like, oh, that's incredibly interesting. And maybe you research it more. Maybe you're like, that was cool, I'm not interested in it. Right. Instead of spending like 10 hours reading a book about it and then realizing halfway through you don't care.
And taking this very hard anti-book stance. But it had to be done. Someone had to do it. Someone had to speak up.
That being said, I do love fiction. Yes, Gone Girl was an amazing book to read. I loved it. It made my plane ride so good. You can get fiction through movies and even podcasts like The Black Tapes and Tannis. But I do
think at the end of the day, there is something about picking up a hardcover book and reading it front to back. It does give you some satisfaction.
No, I love owning books. I have comic books in my room. I have a bookshelf made out of milk crates. I do, in fact, own books, and we're not anti-book on this podcast. We are pro having a podcast, listening to podcasts.
Pro new media, emerging media.
I'm going to end the podcast there, but in case anyone cared from last week, I did get into grad school. So,
yay, grad school!
So I'm really excited about that. I was incredibly worried back when we were recording the last podcast because I hadn't written my personal statement, but by the time it did come out last Wednesday, I had gotten the news that I did get in. So we got in. I just finished my beer. Thank you so much, Dante, for being my guest.
I'm happy to be here, and thank you so much for having me. I didn't finish either of my bottles of hard liquor, but I think that that's probably a good thing.
That is a good thing.
My cat just ran at full speed across my phone. So I think he's telling me that you should wrap up your podcast. I think Dipper has put down, he's put his foot down, literally, and said, you know what, Maggie? It's gone on too long. It's time to go.
Also, Dipper is Dante's cat, in case anyone cares.
He's my cat who is currently running around the house at about 100 miles an hour.
A cutie.
Oh, now he's sitting on my phone.
Cute. He loves it. He wants to be a guest.
We'll have him on next week. I'll set him up with the Zoom and the earbuds, and he can talk to you next week.
Fantastic. Perfect.
Wow.
I know. I'm so funny. Thanks, everyone, for listening. If you want to find us, we are Screen at the Crime on most things. If you want to email us, we are the Screen of the Crime podcast at gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you guys. Also, don't kill anyone and have a fantastic week. Happy Spooktober.
Seriously, don't kill anyone. You'll end up on this podcast, and then everyone will know that you killed someone.
Yeah, and that's going to be embarrassing for you, so don't do it.
You'll never get a job, ever.
Yeah. So bye-bye.